Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with Episode 78 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling The Dryland Doctor, Bill Schillinger, Part 2. If you listen to the first part of my conversation with Schillinger, you know that he had to travel to Nepal and Africa before he could find his way home. Now celebrating his 25th anniversary as agronomist at the Lynn Dryland Research Station, he is concerned about the future of his position. With a hiring freeze in place at Washington State University, as the school puts its financial house in order, he's holding off on any retirement plans. When the experimental station was founded in 1915, the average winter wheat yield in Adams County was just 10 bushels per acre. Today it is 50 bushels. The increase is due to breeding, machinery, soil and residue management, fertilizer, and weed and disease control practices, all elements driven by research. There was a time in the mid-1990s, during another one of WSU's financial emergencies, that Lind was slated for closure. As you can imagine, that didn't sit well with the farmers of the area who depend upon the research conducted there. Ultimately, they rallied to the cause and in 1996 created an endowment to help permanently fund the station. One of the things I like about Schillinger is that he always has the big picture in mind, even while he's researching specific features of farming in a low rainfall environment. Wheat has been and will continue to be king in the summer fallow region of eastern Washington, but as he said in a portion of our conversation that got cut, that doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to look for prince and princess alternative crops that can serve the crown better. That goes for farming practices, too. Schillinger has forgotten more about farming in the summer fallow region than I have ever known, and some of my questions reveal that ignorance. But you never learn unless you ask, and believe me, I learned a lot in my conversation with the Dryland Doctor. I opened part two of my conversation looking for more detail about the emerging practice of direct seeding as part of a summer fallow rotation. I asked Schillinger what his research tells him about successful direct seeding in the low precipitation environment of Adams County and the Okanagan. He opened instead by pointing to another area where the low disturbance farming method is practiced.
Well, let's start off with it where it's really low. Horse heavens, and specifically the western horse heavens, out there, they rarely have enough water to seed early, even if they do some primary tillage. And so it only makes sense for them to direct seed, and many of them and most of them have converted to that. And so that's a very good system for there with the blowing dust coming off the horse heavens. You move further north, coming through Franklin and southern Adams County, you see very little adoption of direct seeding. Again, these soils are sandier. So they're still silt loam soils. And even at the Lind Research Station, our water retention with no-till at Lind Station is not as good. We've done long-term studies with this, and it's much more difficult to get an early stand of wheat with there. But you move to Ritzville, which is not too far away, but 2 inches higher precip, and I think it's very feasible. And these two farmers that I referred to in particular, there's other farmers, but these two farmers are unique because they've adopted the stripper header technology, committed to direct seeding. One actually with a disc type drill, and the other with a hoe type drill. And so two different strategies there. The disc type drill goes through the residue a lot better, but you can't go as deep. The hoe drill can certainly go deeper, but it can't go through the residue as well. So very interesting. And
when we're talking about seeding in a direct seed environment, is the John Deere HZ still the drill that you use in that situation?
No. No one's using a John Deere HZ. If you've ever seen a John Deere HZ in Kemp Fallow, bounces around like crazy. The springs are...
see, this is how I have not stayed up with the technology. But, I mean, you know, when I was a reporter, it was like, you know, we had these two drills, the John Deere HZ or the...
International 150.
International 150, right.
And so we have moved beyond that at this point.
Not really. That's what farmers are farming with to this day. And they're worn out. They're 60-year-old drills. And they want a new drill. And it's got to be a heavier drill and a tougher drill. Those are really light frame drills. I mean, they're great drills. They've been, you know, they've lasted this long, but they're so welded up. And
and you can only use that kind of a drill on land that has been tilled, is uniform.
Historically, those were made for tilled fallow. They work best with tilled fallow. They're not a heavy construction frame. You need a heavier drill to go for the direct seeding, both to get it. Those things won't even go into the ground hardly. The direct seeders have unique direct seed type drills, and they're all different. And I don't want to mention brand names, but they're either disc type, but they're mostly hoe types.
But are they getting down? So they're reaching the moisture. They have to reach the moisture.
They have to reach moisture. And Douglas County is an interesting environment. You know, up north in Douglas County, they don't have a whole lot of soil, 2 to 3 feet of soil. They're successfully producing quite a bit of winter canola. And winter canola, direct seeding winter canola. And that's quite an accomplishment. But you talk to those farmers, and they're putting it down about 3 inches deep, and so their moisture is not as deep as it is further south here, and so that they have a unique environment up there. And you go through Douglas County, you see a lot of canola, and seeding not too deep.
Is there a future for cover crops in this dry area, or are we whistling in the wind?
What do you define as dry area?
Well, the area where you're working, I mean Lind/Ritzville.
Maybe. You know, there's been a lot of interest, as you know, in cover crops, and well-deserved interest. And, you know, this started in the Midwest with this corn-soybean rotation, excess water. You know, too much water and nitrate draining into the Mississippi, just a huge, huge problem. Well, they're introducing cover crops, and they grow them through the winter. They're reducing their leaching. They're producing a different plant. It's just really working well for them, and that's been adopted into other areas of the U.S. and the world, North Dakota. But in the central Great Plains, where it is drier, one of my colleagues, very respected colleague, David Nielsen, who works for the ARS in Akron, Colorado. That's eastern Colorado. That's dry. He did extensive work with cover crops, not only in Colorado, but western Nebraska. Drew Lyon was involved with this before he joined WSU. Several locations, soil cover crops, mixtures, you name it, all sorts. He published 3 papers. And in every one of those mixtures, all of those locations, regardless of the term date when you terminate your cover crop, the subsequent crop following, and most of the time that was wheat, yields were down. And he directly correlated it to water use. He reported this. He was invited to these cover crop conventions. And essentially, he was almost booed off the stage. And they said, well, you're doing something wrong. And he says, what am I doing wrong? And one time they said, well, you don't have the right mixtures. And he said, all right, give me the right mixtures. And he did that with the right mixtures. It didn't make a difference. That was their experience, and it's solid data. I've been through those papers. I've discussed this with him. I've been through those papers. It just makes sense. It's just almost a one-to-one correlation, water use and decline in yield. So I'm skeptically optimistic or pessimist.
I don't know.
You know, but with that said, there is some work up in Douglas County with some farmers, and you know, we're following that. And that'd be wonderful if it worked. I even did some cover crop work a long time ago with Harry Vetch up at the Wilkie Farm. Oh, this is 20 years ago, with different term dates, you know, spray outs, and I found the same thing.
It doesn't make a difference that in the Midwest they get summer precipitation and here we get winter precipitation?
That is the huge difference, of course, and those are just the data from the semi-arid central Great Plains, which are mimic us in total precip, but not in precipitation timing. And so I welcome, you know, the interest in cover crops. I am a bit skeptical if that's if our answer, but maybe it will be. And I know, there's some farmers trying it.
We talked a little bit about the changing weather. Here's another question I have, and it used to be that you could count on winter kill once every 7 years, and I don't think we've had a major winter kill event since 1991. Also, 60 years of research indicates that farmers ordinarily get caught with rain or rapid snow melt on frozen soil about 4 years out of 10. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore. Do you believe you've witnessed the climate changing? And has that caused or helped practices to change? And what about seeding schedules?
I would agree that we are not getting that water runoff, not only in this dry area, but in the Palouse as well. I think you could in the Palouse, a lot of it you could attribute to better residue retention. And in the dry lands, we're not seeing that. It's never was as severe in the dry lands, but we still had it. And sometimes it was severe. And you're right. We don't seem to have that anymore. 25 years ago, at least half the farmers, I would say, were chiseling in the fall, specifically for that purpose. Well, what does chiseling do? You're going to help with your runoff, but then you're in a situation where you've got these big chisel marks in your field, and you have to get out there somewhat early in the spring to close them up. And that's what they said. They got to go close them up. And so you're getting into this whole tillage thing again. Not only are you burying residue in the fall, but you're going out there first thing in the spring, and you can get in trouble really fast doing that. So we're not seeing that anymore. And if people are doing some chiseling, they're generally going to what we call ecolo-tilling, which is a low disturbance. Just put a little narrow mark in there. And many farmers have those. And if you're going to do any kind, if you're worried about it, go use one of those. And you can that's much less disruptive to the soil, and you don't have to go close them up in the spring. So that's been huge. I think that's really been huge. I would agree. We're not seeing the water runoff, and we're seeing much less tillage in the fall.
Interesting.
That didn't answer all your question, though. What was the rest of it?
Do you believe that you are witnessing the climate changing?
Well, I wrote an article with Bob Papendick on history of wheat farming. And we went back and we looked at all these weather records where we had really good records from Lind and the OSU station at Morrow. And the precipitation has always been variable, and it continues to be variable. We've been in a couple wet years. Oh, is it getting wetter? Well, it has the last couple of years, but look at the couple of years before that, and it was pretty bleak. So we didn't see that trend, but what I do see, and maybe this is just a personal thing, but many farmers agree with me on this, is that the summer rains did not receive these, and we're receiving these a lot more.
And these, so the timing of the precipitation has changed.
Especially the summer precip. It used to be rare thunderstorm events, isolated. Now we seem to be getting more of those, as well as regional events moving in. And none of us really remember many of those regional events moving in off the Pacific in the summer, in during July and August, first 2 weeks in September. And again, if we could know we were going to get those, that could really be a game changer as far as what we'd want to do. For example, winter canola. Successful winter canola growers welcome a rain. Comes in harvest, most people say, well, this is the pits, it's slowing me down, I might have some falling number problems, whatever. If you're a canola grower, you just drop everything and get into planting mode. It could change, and if you're a direct seeder, you're going to be wetting through your profile, where if you've tilled tillage mulch, that's likely not going to happen.
So, yes, absolutely.
So that's changed, I think.
We're talking about farmers having to plant into moisture, deep furrow planting. What happened to the deep furrow drill replacement to the John Deere HZ?
As you know, that effort started way back in 2010, where a group of us got together and held some meetings, and over 100 farmers showed up, and we had all sorts of ideas, and we tested some of these, and we thought, well, we had to have big packer wheels, we had to have this, we had to have that. We went through an initial round of testing and found out we did not have to have those, and we learned a lot. And after that, we were able to obtain $350,000 of funding from the state of Washington. Senator Schessler was very instrumental in that effort. And the committee, we had a committee of growers, and I was on that committee as well. We asked for RFPs for some prototypes, and we had some bids, and we selected two that we thought would be the best. And so they got $100,000 each for initial development. And then we had some testing going on, and we had some, and by the way, the criteria for these drills was you need to go through high amounts of residue in both tilled and chem follow. And the rationale there is that, farmers are practicing both chem follow and tilled follow, and this farm, they needed a drill that could, be used on their whole farm for a long time. So we had these two prototypes, and we tested one of them in 2016. The other one wasn't ready, but we again tested both of them in 2017. We had a clear winner as far as, and we put them, it was some tough seeding. It was stripper header residue in both the undercut and chem follow, as well as some more conventional. Some tough seeding situations, and one drill did considerably better than the other. But in our deliberations afterwards, the committee decided that both drills showed enough potential that they deserved further incentive money. So the remaining money was divided 2/3, 1/3 for that. And with that said, the one drill, and I'd prefer not to mention the name or. But it is moving forward to further development. There is a smaller scale manufacturer located in the headquartered in the Great Plains, who's interested in producing this one. It is a hoe type drill with some mechanical flailers for residue clear, hydraulically driven. I was asking about this a while back, and the manufacturer is extremely interested, they're interested, and will move forward with it, but their production schedule is such that they can't get to it until next year. That one is moving forward, so that's good news. And in the meantime, I'd like to, some farmers are building their own drills. They've gone out and bought old frames I won't mention trade names, but there's some frames out there, and they're solid, very solid frames, and they're just sort of building their own drills, and they're having various success. It's probably not perfect. This is much harder than it seems, Scott. It sounds so easy, but it's really quite difficult, especially when you think what kind of drill. I mean, all these different farmers have different needs. What drill is that going to be?
So I did, I don't know whether you are a regular podcast listener, but in episode 40, I titled it Not Just Wheat Country Anymore, and with an interview with Tim McGreevy at the USA Dry Pea and Lentil Council. And Tim suggested that before he retires, which I think is probably 5 to 7 years, there will be 600,000 to 800,000 acres of summer fallow ground going into winter pulses as part of the three-way rotation. What do you think?
Well, that's an ambitious projection, but I don't necessarily disagree, because we have a crop now, and it's winter pea. And maybe we'll have some winter lentils sometime. But we currently have winter pea, and that is extremely promising. We've tested over the years, researchers and farmers alike, all sorts of alternative crops. None of the spring types have been successful. I'd argue, Scott, and I don't, we have a great spring wheat breeder, and spring wheat's an important crop, but in the dry lands, you're not going to make money growing spring wheat, really, and Doug Young and the economists have proven that. But winter planted crops are really doing. I think that's probably our answer, at least with the current technology. You take winter pea, going from 2012 in the drylands, we had essentially 0 acres, and I'd estimate this year we have about 15,000 acres. We've had an exponential increase every year in winter pea production, and Howard Nelson's been really important for that, and Kurt Brownwort at ProGene, and then Rebecca McGee at ARS, the legume breeder. But what's so great about winter pea? Well, it's a big seed. It has unsurpassed emergence, unsurpassed. You can plant this as deep as you need to plant it, and it will come up. You get an inch of rain and a thick crust, no worry. It'll just lift it up like you're taking the roof off of a house. It will emerge. It's easy to produce. It's stable. I've been doing research with winter pea in a cropping systems environment since 2010. Very good luck with that crop. Averaging, again, this is the Dray Farm at Ritzville, 8-year average, almost 2,400 pounds per acre. I had had one failure. That was in 2014, winter kill. Easy to grow, cut it with your conventional combine. But what's exciting is the varieties are getting better. The current variety, Wyndham, is mostly going into a pet food market, 9.5 cents a pound. Hard to get too excited about that. But new varieties are coming out. ProGene has a new variety called Blaze, better winter hardiness similar to winter wheat that can tolerate a -5 degrees Fahrenheit, a taller plant height, makes it a little easier to harvest, bigger pea, that's important for edible food market. The idea is to get these into an edible market and get more money. And Rebecca McGee, she'll be at Lynn Field Day here in less than 2 weeks, and she's got a couple that are looking really good, and let's see if she's going to release those soon. And then she's got more in the pipeline, so it's a really exciting future. I was just in a meeting this week, and Howard Nelson was a speaker. And he did a really good job of outlining the economics of winter wheat.
And Howard is with the Highline Grain now, right?
He's with Highline Grain, and he's been a driver of this winter pea effort, and winter triticale for that matter, too. You know, he outlined the economics of winter wheat, winter pea. These are your expenses. This is more, this is less. It's pretty much a wash. And what I really liked about him was he used 9.5 cents. He said that's what you can realistically expect right now in the pet food market, and it still made sense. It's fixing nitrogen. So it fixes its own nitrogen. You end up with more nitrogen after you harvest the crop than after you harvest the wheat crop, and then it continues to mineralize. I've measured that. I published a paper this last year on my research during the last 8 years, or it was 7 years then, and called it winter pea. Promising new crop for winter wheat, Washington's winter wheat summer fallow region, and it's received a lot of interest. That's not so important, but what's important, it's receiving interest by the farmers. This year, there's farmers that have never done anything but winter wheat summer fallow ever, and some of these farmers are into their 70s. They've never done anything like that. They've got a quarter section of winter peas this year. It's going to take off. So I would like to see some winter lentils, because you can make money on lentils in the winter area.
Now, what about the wheat following the pulse crops, the pea crops?
We don't have any experimental data on that yet, although I do have that in my other cropping systems trial with winter pea. I'm following winter pea in one study, in my longest term study with spring wheat. We are seeing a spring wheat yield bump. You know, it's 3 bushels long term versus after winter wheat. But Howard Nelson. And I'm measuring that, too, in this other one where we're taking it through a chem follow year. Howard says his data suggests that it will continue to mineralize as you go through the follow period, and you'll need much less nitrogen for your subsequent wheat crop than you would with wheat after wheat.
So are we looking at winter peas, fallow, winter wheat?
Yes. And without saying, we can clean up our grass weeds big time with that.
The next few years will be fascinating ones for the state's summer fallow region. Will crops like winter peas, winter canola, and triticale shift farming practices dramatically? Or will we look back in 10 years at yet another much ballyhooed alternative cropping system that didn't go anywhere? I'm frankly looking forward to the day that alternative crops will enrich the soil as they enrich the wallets of the farmers who grow them. Because the more alternatives there are, the better off the land will be. And the more farmers there are, the better off we'll all be. A plea before I close. You all have friends, whether on Facebook or in the flesh. Tell them about Wheat All About It, the only podcast focusing on the Pacific Northwest wheat industry and rural life. If you're listening, you already know the podcast has value to you. Please pass along that value to others. That's all for now. Please join me again next week for another episode of Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead through a history of starvation and times of want and woe. A wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.